The CBS News Weekend Roundup, coming up next.
Say goodbye to thieves. Say hello to CUDA-CAM by Barracuda Networks, the leader in cloud security and storage solutions. CUDA-CAM is a complete cloud-hosted video surveillance solution that captures high-quality footage when motion is detected. Just plug in one or more CUDA-CAM cameras with no network or camera configuration. Video evidence is automatically encrypted and stored in the Barracuda Cloud for secure access from any web browser or mobile device. Visit CUDA-CAM.com to learn why CUDA-CAM is so easy on your wallet, yet so hard to avoid.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Can a recording of Donald Trump saying lewd, vulgar things about women 11 years ago be a bombshell now, with Election Day 4 weeks from this coming Tuesday? The answer seems to be yes. We'll report and analyze in a moment. And we'll review how the running mates did in their one and only debate. Also, remember, it's Trump versus Hillary Clinton and their debate number two this weekend, Sunday, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, on many of these CBS News radio stations and our app for your smartphone. The app is CBS Radio News. Later, Hurricane Matthew had caused terrible destruction in the Caribbean. In Haiti, worst of all, hundreds of people died. The U.S. military is now part of an aid effort. While in Florida, you'll hear our correspondents, including Steve Futterman.
While most of the Central Coast escaped relatively unscathed, authorities received desperate calls for help from some residents who refused to go along with evacuation orders.
And a lot more ahead on this Weekend Roundup. I'm Dan Raviv in Washington. Let's begin with something you've no doubt heard about, a video obtained and released by the Washington Post in which Trump, 11 years ago, is talking in very crude ways about women.
I moved on her like a bitch, and she was married.
A few hours after that was released, Trump posted a video on Facebook in which he apologized, but included also an attack on the Clintons, indicating he planned in Sunday night's debate to talk about the Clintons and how they treated women who alleged abuse. CBS's Major Garrett reported Saturday morning the Trump campaign was in a sudden crisis.
For the first time since the Republican convention, Trump finds himself genuinely isolated, his hold on the nomination less certain than ever.
I said it. I was wrong, and I apologize.
Donald Trump did not apologize at first, though, instead saying his 2005 videotaped comments about groping and kissing women amounted to little more than locker room banter. But under withering criticism from a disgusted Republican Party hierarchy, Trump relented.
I pledge to be a better man tomorrow and will never, ever let you down.
The videotape obtained by the Washington Post showed Trump during a studio lot bus ride with Access Hollywood personality Billy Bush.
I moved on her, and I failed. I'll admit it.
Whoa.
I did try and her. She was married, and all of a sudden I see her. She's now got the big phony and everything. She's totally changed her looks.
Trump, who had recently married his current wife, Melania, also freely discussed his physically aggressive moves on women and the supposed license that came with celebrity.
And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
Whatever you want.
Grab them by the I can do anything.
But Trump's apology was defiant as he used the opportunity to attack Hillary and Bill Clinton.
Bill Clinton has actually abused women, and Hillary has bullied, attacked, shamed, and intimidated his victims.
Utah Senator Mike Lee said Trump should leave the race. And Illinois Senator Mark Kirk suggested the GOP use emergency rules to replace Trump atop the ticket.
Even more strongly, Saturday, a member of the Republican leadership, Senator John Thune of South Dakota, wrote this on Twitter: Donald Trump should withdraw and Mike Pence should be our nominee, effective immediately. The Republican National Committee could actually do that if Trump stands aside, but Trump told newspaper reporters, "There's zero chance I'll quit. I never quit." Running mate Governor Pence issued a statement that he does not condone what Trump said on that video from 2005 and cannot defend it. But Pence said he's grateful that Trump expressed remorse and apologized. Also, we pray for his family. Is it easy for a Republican congressman to break away from Trump? Joe Heck, who's now running for the U.S. Senate in Nevada, was heckled when he declared at an outdoor rally,
"I cannot in good conscience continue to support Donald Trump, nor can I vote for Hillary Clinton. My wife, my daughters, my mom, my sister, and all women deserve better."
Republicans openly saying Mike Pence should be their candidate. He was widely praised for his debate performance against Senator Tim Kaine, Hillary Clinton's running mate. Reporting on that Tuesday night VP debate, CBS's Nancy Cordes began with Democrat Kaine.
I cannot believe that Governor Pence will defend the insult-driven campaign that Donald Trump has run.
Clinton's running mate went on offense within the first 2 minutes.
You guys love Russia.
You both repeatedly jumping in and pressing Pence to justify Trump's most contentious comments.
When Donald Trump says Mexicans are rapists and criminals, I can't imagine how you can defend that.
Pence's strategy was neither to defend nor disavow, but deflect. Yes.
You whipped out that Mexican thing again.
Or deny.
If Donald Trump had said all the things that you said he said in the way you said he said them, he still wouldn't have a fraction of the insults that Hillary Clinton leveled when she said that half of our supporters were a basket of deplorables.
And the day after the debate, what was said Wednesday?
Didn't Mike Pence do a great job?
Some people think I won.
Mike Pence and Donald Trump did a victory lap through three battleground states Wednesday.
Where I sat, Donald Trump won that debate.
Trump praised Pence and himself.
I'm getting a lot of credit because that's really my first so-called choice. That was my first hire.
Hillary Clinton chimed in from a fundraiser in Washington, D.C.
When your own running mate won't defend the top of the ticket, I think that tells you everything you need to know.
Another subject likely to come up in the Sunday night Trump versus Clinton debate, hackers obtained parts of Hillary Clinton's highly paid speeches to bankers and finance companies after she left the job of Secretary of State in 2013. CBS's Paula Reed reports.
There have been calls for her to release transcripts of these speeches for well over a year now from her opponents and from major media organizations. But here, after reading through these WikiLeaks documents, what you see is that her own words really hit on her own perceived weaknesses, particularly around relatability and trust. For example, she told one Wall Street group that while she grew up in a very middle-class household, she's now far removed from it. I mean, she's rich. In another speech, she talks about how the electorate sometimes gets a little nervous when they hear about backroom deals or any compromises. So she says, and I quote, politicians need both a public and a private position to appease voters. So you see why she really wasn't in a hurry to release these, as again, it really highlights a lot of concerns that voters have about her.
Also, the State Department on Friday released emails that Hillary Clinton sent from her private server. She or her team erased them, though they were work-related. The FBI found them in the records of colleagues who received the messages.
They found over 15,000 emails that had never been released. But the FBI didn't know if these were emails that should have been withheld, if they were private documents, or if they were public records. So they handed them over to the State Department. They said, hey, look, we found these. You should look through them and see if there's anything that should have been released. So over the next few weeks, the State Department is releasing any emails that should have been released in the past during other lawsuits, Freedom of Information Act requests, seeking these documents. But none of them are really any bombshells. It's mostly things that have already been released with a few extra words like please print or something like that.
That's CBS's Paula Reed here in Washington. A lot more politics coming up, but next we'll report on Hurricane Matthew on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Dan Raviv. Millions of Americans living near the Atlantic coast knew for days that Hurricane Matthew was almost definitely going to approach. Even if the eye of the hurricane did not officially make landfall, the winds and rain would do damage. And they did. Worst of all, the number of deaths in the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, Haiti, in part because many homes are just shacks. They get buried by mud and water every time there's a big storm. The number of deaths in Haiti from Matthew approaching 500 as of Friday. CBS News correspondent Omar Villafranca reported from the Bahamas on how the Caribbean was hit hard.
Powerful winds and relentless rain slammed the Bahamas, making it clear Hurricane Matthew had arrived. Snapshots from Great Inagua show the storm's power. Homes damaged, streets covered in debris, trucks tossed on their side.
The wind is slicing through the Bahamas as the storm gets closer to the shore. Beaches are empty, homes are boarded up, and here on Exuma Island, most of the people are without electricity.
As the storm approached from the south, Nassau resident Jenny Minus evacuated her home and headed to a shelter.
So far, I'm okay. I just hope no lives are lost.
The aftermath in Haiti shows the devastating power of Matthew. Buildings in Jeremy are nearly destroyed. Many roofs were ripped clean off. The U.S. government has sent experts to Haiti to assess the damage and is offering $1 million in food assistance, along with another $500,000 worth of non-food items like blankets and temporary shelters for Haiti, Jamaica, and the Bahamas.
Omar Villafranca reported Thursday on destruction in the Caribbean. Many residents of Florida feel lucky. It could have been far worse. Scott Pelley was anchoring the CBS Evening News from the Florida coast. And Friday morning, Scott reported,
we had winds here in Palm Beach last night of only about 50 miles an hour below hurricane force. There's virtually no damage to be seen anywhere around here. The southern part of the state, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, the Palm Beaches, have literally dodged a bullet.
The Category 4 hurricane sustained winds over 130 miles per hour, weakened to Category 3, then 2, but those winds are still over 95 miles an hour. Florida did not feel the full force, but preparations for wind and floods continued up the coast in Georgia and the Carolinas. We have two reports.
This is Steve Futterman in Melbourne, Florida. While most of the central coast escaped relatively unscathed, there were problems in some areas. North of here, near Cape Canaveral, authorities received desperate calls for help from some residents who refused to go along with evacuation orders. One person told officials that the roof had flown off his home. Initially, rescue crews were not able to respond because it was too dangerous.
I'm Peter King in Orlando. Reports all over central Florida, down trees, down power lines. Major roads are open, but there are a number of side streets that are blocked by some of those trees that have come down. There is a curfew here in Orange County and in other counties here in central Florida, with officials asking people, telling people, stay inside, don't go out anywhere, wait until the storm has passed.
Farther north on Jacksonville Beach, a little south of the border with Georgia, CBS's Jim Crisula on Friday.
Weather conditions continue to worsen here as Hurricane Matthew moves closer. It's starting to be too dangerous just to be outside. In fact, police are telling us to get off the beach. Things are starting to fly through the air. Waves are crashing ashore. The palm trees are bending and waving, swaying wildly. The torrent of rain continues to swirl in from the ocean. At times, there's an unnerving howl from the wind.
Now, related or not, climate change. A significant international accord hammered out last year, the Paris Agreement to reduce carbon emissions, has now been ratified by enough countries to make it official. Coming into force next month, the U.S. and China approved it. Then Wednesday, several European countries ratified it, so countries emitting more than 55% of carbon into our atmosphere are now part of the deal. CBS News White House correspondent Pam Coulter reported.
President Obama called it a turning point for the planet.
This gives us the best possible shot to save the one planet we've got.
He said the U.S. led the way with the first ever nationwide standards on power plant emissions, big trucks, and soon aircraft.
We've changed fundamentally the way we consume energy.
While it won't completely solve the climate crisis, the president said it will help delay or avoid the worst consequences of climate change. Pam Coulter, CBS News, The White House.
In South America, a landmark deal between the government of Colombia and the Marxist guerrilla army called FARC, meant to end a civil war after 52 years, was rejected by Colombian voters. By a small majority, but still rejected, especially in parts of Colombia where there'd been a lot of violence and people apparently did not want to forgive and forget. Then Friday, the Norwegian Nobel Committee awarded the Nobel Peace Prize to the president of Colombia, Juan Manuel Santos. Note that the prize is not being shared with the FARC commander, though he also was shaking hands last month and hailing the end of murders, kidnappings, and other attacks. More from CBS News reporter Larry Miller in London.
The Nobel Committee says it hopes by awarding the 2016 Peace Prize to Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos, the country's civil war will finally end. Nobel Committee leader Casey Coleman, 5.
President Santos, despite the majority vote in the referendum, has brought the bloody conflict significantly closer to a peaceful solution.
The Nobel Committee says despite the public vote, the Colombians' desire for peace remains strong. The Peace Prize is meant to encourage that. Larry Miller, CBS News.
Now on the Nobel Prize for Physics, here's CBS News correspondent Steve Kathan.
British-born scientists David Thewlis, Duncan Haldane, and Michael Kosterlitz are all linked with American universities. Their research on the behavior of matter opened new pathways for electronics and superconductors. Haldane spoke from Princeton, New Jersey.
You never kind of set out to discover something new. You stumble on it and you have the luck to recognize what you found is something very interesting.
He says he's surprised and gratified by the honor. Steve Kathan, CBS News.
Now to Townville, South Carolina. How sad. The funeral of a 6-year-old who was shot by a teenager who also wounded 2 other people outside a school after murdering his father. That's according to police and prosecutors who want to try the 14-year-old as an adult. Jacob Hall, who'd been shot in the leg but died from blood loss, was a great kid and a huge fan of comic book and movie superheroes. So people in the church were encouraged to show up in costume. A man named John Buckland, dressed as Batman, delivered a eulogy.
May a 6-year-old boy become such a part of our lives that this community shows the rest of the world what hope is all about.
Hope and faith after violence and tragedy in Townville, South Carolina. Up next, we go back to politics, the VP debate, and we look forward to Trump versus Clinton this weekend, Sunday night. Stay with the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
It's finally fall. The weather is cooling off, and there's no better time to upgrade your cookouts than right now. Let me tell you about Omaha Steaks. They have a huge menu of steaks and more. The process is convenient and quick, shopping delivered straight to your door. Every purchase is backed by Omaha Steaks' 100% unconditional guarantee. And right now, you can get the limited-time family grill pack for just $49.99. You get all of this. 2 5-ounce filet mignons, 2 5-ounce top sirloins, 4 4-ounce boneless pork chops, 4 3.5-ounce chicken fried steaks, 12-ounce package of all-beef meatballs, 4 4-ounce Omaha Steak Burgers, 4 4-ounce Gourmet Jumbo Franks, a 16-ounce package of Omaha Steakhouse Fries, 4 Caramel Apple Tartlets, OS Seasoning Packet, plus 4 additional Omaha Steaks Burgers. Just for listening, Omaha Steaks is offering all of this for only $49.99. This is a huge savings. Go to omahasteaks.com, enter code FTN in the search bar, and add the Family Grill Pack to your cart. Don't miss this deal. Visit omahasteaks.com and enter code FTN in the search bar to get over 30 gourmet items for just $49.99.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, back to politics, I'm Dan Raviv. Before you forget totally, and perhaps you will, about the debate between the vice presidential candidates this past Tuesday, here are highlights of Democrat Tim Kaine versus Republican Mike Pence. First, Pence.
Donald Trump and I have a plan to get this economy moving again, just the way that it worked in the 1980s, just the way it worked in the 1960s. And that is by lowering taxes across the board for working families, small businesses, and family farms.
First thing we do is we invest in manufacturing, infrastructure, and research in the clean energy jobs of tomorrow.
My faith informs my life. I try and spend a little time on my knees every day, but it all for me begins with cherishing the dignity, the worth, the value of every human life.
We can encourage people to support life, of course we can, but why don't you trust women? Why doesn't Donald Trump trust women to make this choice for themselves?
A society can be judged by how it deals with its most vulnerable, the aged, the infirm, the disabled, and the unborn. I believe it with all my heart, and I couldn't be more proud to be standing with a pro-life candidate in Donald Trump.
Donald Trump recently said we need to do more stop and frisk around the country. That would be a big mistake because it polarizes the relationship between the police and the community. So here's what we'll do. We'll focus on community policing.
We ought to assure the public that we'll have a full and complete and transparent investigation whenever there's a loss of life because of police action. But Senator, please, enough of this seeking every opportunity to demean law enforcement broadly by making the accusation of implicit bias every time tragedy occurs.
Elaine, people shouldn't be afraid to bring up issues of bias in law enforcement. And if you're afraid to have if you're afraid to have the discussion, you'll never solve it.
The moderator who tried to reduce the interrupting was my colleague, CBS News correspondent Elaine Quijano. Our political director, John Dickerson, offered his analysis on CBS This Morning, quizzed by Charlie Rose.
Yesterday, you cited the Hippocratic Oath, which says, first, do no harm. Did the aggressiveness of Tim Kaine do harm? And did Mike Pence do harm on content?
Yes, he was aggressive, wasn't he? At times, it felt like it was an interruption, and occasionally a debate broke out. I think that it depends what your game was. I mean, clearly Tim Kaine's goal going into this was to keep the general election in mind and keep driving the issues of Donald Trump and what he'd said and keep those in the forefront. His demeanor and constant interruptions undoubtedly came across as just too much for viewers. Mike Pence was all the things that Donald Trump was not in his debate. He'd clearly studied, and he was unflappable pretty much in the face of all those interruptions. I think basically the big challenge for the Trump campaign is not the style in the night, but Mike Pence's disconnect with his own candidate. He didn't rush to his defense when Kaine attacked him. And then there were those issues where Pence said things that Donald Trump didn't say that Donald Trump indeed did say.
Or will performance trump content?
Right, exactly. And you know, in debates, performance does trump content when it's the people at the top of the ticket. But when it's the undercard, usually what happens is basically everybody moves back to the general election conversation with face to go to the next debate. We'll probably be through five or six other stories before we have that debate on Sunday.
John Dickerson, who is host of Face the Nation on CBS every Sunday. Let's turn to CBS News correspondent Stephen Portnoy, part of our radio coverage of all the debates. Stephen, considering the wider presidential campaign, what's different this year?
Well, just think about it, Dan. We are 4 weeks from Tuesday away from Americans casting their ballots for this presidential election. In many states, they're already voting now. And it's striking just to think about how different this race is. The Hillary Clinton camp, according to an Associated Press analysis, has spent about $200 million on campaign ads. You know how much Donald Trump has spent on campaign ads?
A lot less, but how much?
About a tenth of the total that Clinton has spent, $23.6 million, as opposed to the $200 million that the Clinton camp has spent so far. It's indicative of the extent to which this Republican nominee has relied almost entirely on what the political trade calls earned media, free media, that is, this kind of media, news media. And Trump has just decided to not spend money on advertising. It seems rather simple and intuitive. He's very well known, but he's also not using money to try to persuade people in commercial time. And it's very different, not to mention the fact that this Republican candidate has next to no ground game. And here's an illustration. In the state of Florida, there are statistics that indicate that there are more than 400,000 new Democratic registered voters and only about 60 or 70,000 new registered Republicans. Doesn't necessarily mean that Florida's off the table for Donald Trump, but it's an illustration of the extent to which Clinton's ground game is mobilizing to register Democrats in that pivotal battleground state, and the Republican Party just hasn't been as effective.
And that also does cost money, so Trump chose not to spend the money, or he and the folks closest to him are just not used to running that kind of campaign, and the people around Hillary Clinton sure are.
Trump didn't need to spend money, he feels, in the primaries to vanquish his 16 rivals, and so he figures he can do it and also be a model for how he would run a federal government if he became elected president, spend less money in a more efficient way.
All right, let's shift focus to this weekend's big event, Sunday. In St. Louis or just outside, you'll be there. So this is Trump versus Clinton, the second of their three debates. Just set the scene. It's at a university again?
Washington University in St. Louis. It's the town hall debate. There'll be two moderators. It's hard to know how this will play out. But remember, town halls historically have offered candidates an opportunity to connect with voters. The first time it was done in 1992, Bill Clinton used it to his advantage, connecting with voters on their economic concerns, while his opponent, George Herbert Walker Bush, appeared to be distant, looked at his watch, seemed bored.
Are you saying the questions won't come from CNN's Anderson Cooper and ABC's Martha Raddatz?
Half of them will. But the other half will come from the voters assembled by the Gallup organization. These are people who describe themselves as uncommitted. Doesn't necessarily mean they're undecided, but they're at least willing to consider changing and going for another candidate.
What do we know about the preparations? Hillary Clinton generally, takes briefing books and, well, just does it in that old-fashioned, serious way. What about Trump?
Well, Trump has not been practicing, as best we can tell. There was an event he held Thursday night in New Hampshire that was said to be something of a scrimmage. It was promoted as a town hall event. There was even a 2-minute countdown clock. The questions did not come, though, directly from voters. Instead, they were filtered up through the host, a talk radio host and columnist in Boston named Howie Carr. He asked the questions of Trump. They were almost entirely friendly questions, softball questions, and Trump sort of meandered and talked about other things. He even made fun of a CNN anchor as opposed to directly answering some of the questions. So in as much as it was meant to be, if it was meant to be practice, it probably wasn't the most effective practice for Sunday night's debate.
That's CBS News correspondent Stephen Portnoy. Thanks very much.
You bet.
Please follow us on Twitter. He's at Stephen Portnoy. We have headlines day and night at CBS Radio News. And I'm at Dan Revive on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Here on the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Dan Revive. We'll have more analysis of the debates and what to look for in the remaining weeks of campaign 2016, Trump versus Clinton. But first, a few other stories. Federal prosecutors have revealed that in late August, the FBI arrested a man in Maryland who worked as a contractor inside the NSA, the National Security Agency. He allegedly had classified data at home and perhaps in his car, not known as what he intended to do, become a famous leaker like Edward Snowden, sell secrets to foreign spies, or maybe he was just doing some work in his spare time. CBS News Homeland Security correspondent Jeff Pagaz picks up the story.
The investigation began in August after sensitive NSA information about U.S. hacking tools ended up online, even though they now have a suspect in custody. Law enforcement sources say investigators are still not confident that all of the U.S. secrets Harold Martin allegedly stole have been accounted for and recovered. In addition, law enforcement sources say they are trying to determine whether anyone else was involved. When the FBI searched Harold Martin's Maryland home, they found hard copy documents and digital information that contained highly classified material. According to the complaint released Wednesday, Martin first denied stealing the top secret information, but later said he knew what he had done was wrong. Debbie Martin is his wife.
You know, he's a good man, and that's all I can really tell you.
In a statement, the suspect's attorney said, at this point, these are mere allegations. There is no evidence that Hal Martin intended to betray his country. The 51-year-old served in the Navy for 5 years before spending another 3 in the active reserves. Martin was working at the NSA as a contractor after being hired by Booz Allen Hamilton, where, according to CBS News analyst, he would have had top secret security clearance.
We must ensure whistleblowers can act again.
The company is facing its second major black eye in 3 years after it hired NSA leaker Edward Snowden. In 2013, Snowden released thousands of documents revealing the NSA's controversial surveillance program. After Snowden's leak, Booz Allen strengthened their program for detecting insider threats. In a statement, House Intelligence Committee member Adam Schiff called the latest security breach distressing. He said it is painfully clear that the intelligence community still has much to do to institutionalize reforms designed to protect in advance the nation's sources and methods from insider threats. John Carlin is U.S. Assistant Attorney General.
What can happen is you have amazing defenses to protect your intellectual property, but you forget sometimes to have a program where you're watching those who you trust.
Booz Allen says it fired Martin immediately once it learned of his arrest and that it is cooperating with this investigation.
That from CBS's Jeff Pagaz. Now the deepening bitterness between Washington and Moscow, especially over the civil war in Syria. Russia supports the dictator there. Russian planes bomb various rebel groups, including ISIS. The U.S. and its allies are bombing ISIS, but support some of the rebels. CBS News correspondent Cammy McCormick reports John Kerry was angry on Friday.
Secretary Kerry said the Syrian regime struck another hospital in Aleppo, and the regime and Russia owe the world an explanation for why they keep hitting medical facilities, women and children.
These are acts that beg for an appropriate investigation of war crimes.
Kerry said the attacks go way beyond the accidental now.
This is a targeted strategy to terrorize civilians and to kill anybody and everybody who is in the way of their military objectives.
Carrie's strong words come as U.S.-Russian relations continue their downward spiral. Cammie McCormick, CBS News, Washington.
In New York, the United Nations has chosen a new Secretary General. Ban Ki-moon, who's from South Korea, is ending his term. Now the UN will have a new leader. It's an influential job trying to be a voice of morality and justice in the world. CBS News analyst Pamela Falk, you cover things for us at UN headquarters in New York. Tell us, please, who's getting the job?
The next UN Secretary General will be Antonio Guterres, a former Prime Minister of Portugal who served 10 years as the UN's High Commissioner on Refugees, dealing with Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and Libya after an early career of political activism fighting dictatorship in Portugal in the 1960s and 70s.
Naturally, he'll be very concerned about refugees from the Syrian civil war and elsewhere. What else is on his plate?
Diplomats hope that the next UN chief will restore credibility, help to warm relations that have soured between the U.S. and Russia, move the climate agreement forward, and help end poverty. A lot to ask of anyone.
And Pam, though the U.S., Russia, and perhaps the three other permanent members of the Security Council could have argued their way into a stalemate on selecting a new Secretary General, did it turn out to be easy for them to agree on this politician from Portugal?
The vetting process was unusual for the race because, unlike the past where the UN chief was chosen in back-channel negotiations by the Security Council, this time candidates were vetted in a series of public hearings by representatives from 193 nations. By tradition, the Secretary General job is supposed to alternate between regions, and it was the turn of Eastern Europe. In addition, several organizations pressed to have the first woman. But this week, in a rare show of international unity, all 15 members of the UN Security Council emerged from behind closed doors and announced Guterres as their consensus candidate.
Professor Pamela Falk, covering the UN for CBS News. Now to our senior political editor, Steve Chigaris, on the debate between vice presidential candidates this past Tuesday. Steve, did it really matter?
Ultimately, people aren't voting for either of these characters. They're voting for Donald Trump and they're voting for Hillary Clinton. So it's about how well did they push the top of the ticket. I think if you listen to Tim Kaine, he was really out there criticizing Donald Trump very heavily, putting Pence on his heels, trying to defend Trump. And Pence, on the other hand, was also trying to do the same about Hillary Clinton. So what voters got out of that, I don't know. There were a lot of moments where they were talking over each other and talking over the moderator. But there were also some moments that I think showed a little bit about who these gentlemen were when they talked about abortion and faith and when they talked about how they would serve as vice president.
And we have two more debates between Trump and Clinton, including this weekend, Sunday night. Live coverage, of course, from CBS News on radio, TV, online at CBSN. But this past week, where have things been heading? When I spoke to you a week ago, Steve, it was like Hillary Clinton's decline had stopped and maybe Donald Trump was having a bad week. So what about the past few days?
Well, it seems like she's picked up a little momentum, at least enough to get her back to where she was before she started having her bad weeks. She is up 4 points in the latest CBS News national poll. It was tied in the last CBS News poll, so she's up 4 points post-debate and post-Donald Trump's bad week. So she's feeling a little bit better, breathing a little bit easier after that first debate. But as we know, these debates are important. A lot of people watch.
And a lot listen on the radio. That's Steve Chigaris, CBS News senior political editor. Still to come, the importance of vacations and taking a break during the workday. Also, the politics of American doctors. Those stories and more on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Posting your job in just one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites, and now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with one single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No more juggling emails or calls to your office. You can quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 800,000 businesses. And right now, listeners of the show can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. That's ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. One more time so you can try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Dan Revive. 71 years after the end of World War II, books are still being written. Of course, movies are being made, often based on new discoveries about the war, including the Holocaust, the murder by Nazi Germany of 6 million Jews. In London, CBS News correspondent Vicky Barker reports a new claim by a German author that the Nazi leader Adolf Hitler was a drug addict.
His favorite drug was Eucodal, which is a pharmacological cousin of heroin, but with a much higher potential for making you euphoric.
Norman Ohler says Hitler's medical records show that in his early days in power, he had regular vitamin and glucose injections, but that changed.
When the war against Russia turned bad in the October of 41, he turned to steroids and hormone products. Pretty unsavory things got into his veins. And then in 43 and especially 44, he turned to opiates.
Ohler says that drug abuse was behind Hitler's doomed and delusional 1944 plan to encircle and destroy British and Canadian forces in France. This when the German army was already decimated and outnumbered.
Just before he announced that to his baffled generals, he took a huge dose of cocaine. So you can try to understand in what state of mind he was when he was making certain decisions.
To British World War II historian Anthony Beaver, it makes other events that year make sense too.
It is an explanation of why the British in 1944 decided no longer to attempt to assassinate Hitler, because they realized at this particular stage that the Allies would win the war more rapidly with Hitler in command than Hitler being replaced by somebody else.
The title of Ohler's book, Blitzed, Nazi Drugs in Germany. I'm Vicky Barker, CBS News.
Now the politics of American doctors. A new study says among physicians who've registered with one party or the other, around two-thirds are Republicans. Your surgeon is highly likely to be a Republican. Your psychiatrist very likely to be a Democrat. And does that affect how they treat patients? CBS News correspondent Barry Bagnato reports.
Politics pervades pretty much everything, even your doctor's office. Yale researchers led by Eitan Hirsch looked at how a physician's party affiliation impacted approaches to
abortion, guns, marijuana.
There were significant differences in perceptions of seriousness and treatment choices. Patients who smoke pot regularly,
very concerning to Republican doctors and not so concerning to Democratic doctors. A patient who has small kids in their home and stores guns, that's something that's concerning to Democrats.
This suggests, he says, doctors need to develop a political sensitivity similar to the one they should have for race. This study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Barry Bagnato, CBS News, Washington.
Now to American work habits. In general, we work too hard. That's what Tony Schwartz says. His studies find that in most foreign industrialized countries, work stops more often to give some rest and relaxation. He's founder of the Energy Project, which coaches companies on how to get more from their workforce, including more break time during the workday to help employees recharge. Tony Schwartz spoke about that in conversation with CBS's Jeff Glor, Christina Johnson, and Jamie Yukas.
Since 1978, Americans' vacation usage has steadily declined. Why aren't Americans taking their vacation time?
You know, I think there's several reasons. I mean, I think putting everything else aside, people feel scared that if they do take vacation, they'll come back to no job. That's a legacy of the recession. But the second reason is that people actually don't feel as if they have value if they're not working. We're so focused on what we do that we lose connection to the idea that we have any value if we're not working.
From the health and wellness and productivity perspective, is it better, if you're going to take the vacations, to do the shorter ones, 3 or 4 days, or a longer one, 2 weeks? What's the most effective thing to do?
First of all, you're conditioned by whatever your employer allows you to do. But from my perspective, as someone who's fourth summer of a 30-day vacation.
So I
run a company that, you know, goes and tells employers to give more vacation, not less. We give 5 weeks to people in their first year. So what we've learned is that it really helps to take a more extended vacation. I'm not suggesting that most people are going to be able to take 4 weeks, The problem is it takes time to wind down, and you're more anxious in the early days than you would be if you took a little bit longer.
And it could take 5 or 6 days to get there.
There's no question. And then if you're taking a week's vacation on the last day, you're fine, starting to feel relaxed, and before the day ends, you're on your way home.
You said you offer 5 weeks vacation. There are these startup companies that offer unlimited vacation. Why do you think that's a terrible idea?
What it does is it actually imposes on people guilt about any vacation they take. If somebody says to you, you have 3 weeks vacation, you feel comfortable or more comfortable taking that. If somebody says to you, take as much as you want, but we'll be noticing, the odds are you're not going to take as much. So a really poor idea. We need boundaries.
How do companies encourage employees to take vacation?
I mean, the number one way is for the person who's
in charge. Or do they?
Yes, they don't. They very surely don't in many companies. But the number one way is to role model it. So it's what I'm trying to do is I'm not only trying to take a vacation for myself, but as another reason to take it, I want other people to feel comfortable taking it.
And not feel guilty about it, right?
No. In fact, I think as we started, it actually increases your likelihood of being productive. And there's good research saying that there's an EY study of 50,000 people, Ernst & Young, that found that people's performance reviews increased the quality of the performance review with every additional vacation day they took.
Well, there's one study that says that employees who took 11 or more vacation days a year were more likely to receive a recent raise or a bonus than employees who took less time. Why is that?
Very much the same idea, that the question is not how many hours you work. The question is, what do you accomplish during the hours you work? So I think of it as kind of, I call it interval life. This is operating not as a marathoner where you're constantly holding back on spending all your energy, but you're fully investing and then you're refueling. And that's a very different way of working. And I think it's the only way in a world of relentlessly rising demand that people are going to be, or the companies are going to be able to get the best from their employees.
And I think the families benefit too.
Clearly, although, you know, there's no small number of people who don't like to take vacations because they know that being with their families is harder than working.
Tony Schwartz, his company that advocates more vacation time and more breaks during the workday, is called the Energy Project. Let's end with a report from Rome. Pope Francis left the Vatican without any announcement beforehand. He didn't want to make a fuss, but he did want to go to the Italian towns hit hard by the earthquake of August 24th. CBS's Sabina Castelfranco reported this past Tuesday.
It was unexpected. Pope Francis visited the towns and villages devastated by the August earthquake, which killed nearly 300 people. He comforted residents who have lost their homes and all their possessions. The Pope prayed amid the rubble in the worst-hit town of Amatrice and said he would have liked to visit earlier, but did not want to bother anyone with his presence. Sabina Castelfranco, CBS News, Rome.
That's it for this weekend roundup. Anytime you want to hear us, including episodes from past weekends, please do an internet search for CBS Weekend Roundup. You'll find our podcasts. Also, on our app for your smartphone, the free app is CBS Radio News. Don't forget, this Sunday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll broadcast the second debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, 9 p.m. Sunday. The Weekend Roundup is produced at CBS News in Washington by Howard Arenstein. I'm Dan Revive. Have a great week.